This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 52. We will talk about Azure news, conferences. We're going to take a listener question on InfoPath. Welcome to the Microsoft Cloud Show, the only place to stay up to date on everything going on in the Microsoft Cloud world, including Windows Azure, Office 365, SharePoint, Exchange, Link, and related technologies. Just the information, no marketing, no BS. I'm Chris Johnson.
And I'm Andrew Cole.
And we're just two dudes telling you how we see it.
Hey, well, good morning, AC. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. How about yourself, CJ?
Very nice. Well, very good, I should say. I'm in San Fran.
What are you doing in San Francisco?
I am here for possibly the largest conference on Earth. It's the Dreamforce conference, which is Salesforce. Do one big event a year, and this is it. It's 145,000 people.
Oh my God! Just a couple of friends. How big is the venue? Like, do they have one venue that they're putting everybody in?
No, it's pretty spread out. So it's in San Fran. Like I said, it's at the Moscone Center. So it's if you've ever visited Moscone, that's more than one building, right? There's Moscone North, South, West. There's a bunch of hotels nearby that are also part of the conference. The Marriott's part of the conference, and a few, like, it's spread across sort of 8 or 10 different venues.
God, that's got to be one heck of a challenge to organize and coordinate that entire thing.
Oh, I can't imagine it. I thought SharePoint conference was bad enough, and that was 10,000 people.
God, you sit there and you think about the scale of this. You think about, you know, like you said, SharePoint conference, 10,000 people. You think about how small it really is, and you're just like, I know that there's one person at the top who's running the whole show, and I know that they have an entire team, but can you imagine what that one person, what their life is like this week?
No, I don't want to.
Golly, that is just nuts running all over the place. It's got to be just a complete nightmare.
It's actually done really well. Like, the conference is great. It's there's lots of stuff going on. There's sessions. There's like multiple expo halls with all sorts of different, there's a whole sort of building almost dedicated just to developer. So it's really interesting. There's all sorts of stuff going on here. There's Bruno Mars played on Tuesday night along with Cake, the band, and
Bruno Mars brought some nice, you know, yellow stuffed cake or something. He's like, we watched Bruno Mars with some nice, you know, a German Dutch cake.
yeah, exactly. No, they were playing at the same time, but so if you didn't like Bruno Mars, you could go see this other band. And they were both really good. Will.i.am was here and launching his new company for like a wearable bracelety watch type thing, which sounded really cool. Huh. And Hillary Clinton keynoted. Tony Robbins was another keynote. Like, it's done very differently from the other technology conferences I've been at, and it was kind of refreshing, actually. It was really nice.
That's interesting. That's like you're saying, they break everything up in like different buildings, like a developer building or something. And just imagine if you're trying to be an expo or participate in an expo. I mean, if you go to multiple places, I wonder, there's probably some companies that are actually expoing in multiple, have multiple booths in multiple places.
Oh yeah. Yeah. A lot of them.
God, that's crazy. That's just totally different scale, man. Totally different scale.
Oh, I've never seen anything like it. Like I've heard that there are conferences this big for all sorts of other stuff, like SEMA for the car show and stuff, which is like 250,000 people or something. Mm-hmm. But I've never been to one, so this is kind of interesting to watch.
Man, they got San Francisco's got to be loving all that influx coming in for all that business.
Oh yeah, I think Uber is like surge charging like 10 times or something.
Hey, I got a question for you then. So on the subject of conferences, I understand that there's a little conference that might have gotten announced today. We're recording this on October the 16th. So a little something got announced today you wanted to share?
Yeah. So a while back, Microsoft said it was going to combine a bunch of conferences together, right? So SharePoint Conference, Link, Project Exchange, and the likes, and TechEd North America. And sort of get rid of so many different conferences and then sort of combine them into this one unified commercial event, I think was what it was described as at the time. And then today it was announced the new name for that conference is going to be Microsoft Ignite. So it's on in Chicago on May the 4th. So all the Star Wars fans will be out in force. I'm going to wear my Stormtrooper outfit for sure. Yeah, so that'll be really cool. I'm looking forward to it. It's next year, obviously, and it's going to be like a much larger conference, but really for, you know, for those folks that couldn't decide between SPC or Link or Project or Exchange Conference, you know, it makes it a bunch easier for them.
So that, you know, I saw the announcement and I see that, you know, it's May the 4th, the week of May the 4th. And then, but then I also see another conference that the Build Conference is the week prior in San Francisco, April 29th through May the 1st. And so
yeah,
I guess, you know, for our audience, which, you know, we try and speak to the Microsoft cloud. And so we've got the, you got the Azure guys, you've got the, and the Office 365 guys. And then I know we got a lot of people that are also interested in SharePoint as well. I guess, do you have any insight or any kind of guidance on which one you would register for? Because like, I look at it as a SharePoint guy and as somebody who's doing a bunch of Azure work as well, I kind of look at it and say, well, going to both of these is a bit out of the question. It just seems like a bit ridiculous to try and do both of those. Go to San Francisco, turn around, fly straight to Chicago, and then doing that.
Yeah.
But it's, I mean, do you have any guidance on which one to go with?
Yeah, I think my take on this, my personal advice is, I think it's relatively simple to decide. I think if you want a 100% dedicated to developer conference, focusing on web and mobile and device development, then I think Build is the conference for you. If you want a conference that's more focused on business software and solutions across all the Microsoft stack of products, then the Microsoft Ignite conference is probably the better choice. But that said, it's not just developers, right? So it's going to be IT pros and business folks and end users as well as developers. So if you just want a conference solely focused on dev, then Build is probably a better choice. For some people it might suit them to go to a conference that's not just for developers, right? Because they might want to go see stuff about, you know, other products that they don't have a lot of knowledge in that doesn't necessarily fall into the typical developer type space. So it really depends on what you're looking for. Like, I'm pumped about Build. I think it's going to rock. And I'm really excited about Microsoft Ignite because it's kind of it's where all of the folks, I believe, that would have gone to a SharePoint conference or an Exchange or Project or Link conference should go.
So I hear you. As somebody who's probably on that side of on the SharePoint dev side or the Office 365 dev side, I know I look at it, I hear what you said, but I'm still kind of like, God, I don't really know. I don't know what I would try to go to, because I mean, on one side, I could see, you know, what you're interested in and what you're actually applying could make a really good argument for each one of them. And I see the blog post even goes even further and talks about Convergence, which I know that's more business side in March. And then there's WPC that's in Orlando in July. So it's got a packed middle of the year coming up.
Yeah, that's pure partner. There is definitely choice, right? But I think this was also really unclear. It was unclear back in the SharePoint conference days because, you know, people were asking the same questions about whether they should go to Build then as well.
Mm, that's true.
So I don't know. I think it's relatively clear. I think it's clear, at least in my mind, right? If you're a pure dev focusing on web and mobile and device development, go to Build. If you're building commercial software or custom solutions for large businesses and enterprises across all sorts of different products, go to the Microsoft Ignite event.
That'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see how it comes out. It's definitely interesting.
One size fits all perfect answer, right? It depends on what you're after.
Sure. I mean, you can't have everything. Can't put everything in one spot. So that's I get the split and everything. So
yeah.
I'd be curious to see what people start thinking about this. So I, you know, anybody that's listening to the show, if you're, you know, which one are you looking at? And I guess, and why? I mean, let us know. I'd love, or, you know, if you're trying to figure out which one to go to, it seems like, you know, our audience is definitely going to be looking at one or the other or even both. So I'd be curious to hear what people are thinking about it.
Well, yeah, and especially if you're doing dev for 365, then it used to be that most SharePoint developers would go to a SharePoint conference, right, and not Build. But now it's like SharePoint development is sort of, you know, it's a lot more webby, right? And all the sessions at Build are generally applicable.
Mm.
So it's, you know, it's opened up Build for that audience a lot more, I think.
Yeah, agreed. I totally agree. I guess we go off on there's a topic that I want to approach in a future show about the new style of like development and how it applies to Azure and what Office 365 is doing in Microsoft's cloud story for business and how that whole web side of it, how important it really is for the web dev, not the traditional like server side dev. So, but that's a topic for a totally different day.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Hey, so moving on, should we get to some news?
Is there a special thing about this episode that we were going to talk about? Like maybe episode 52?
Oh, I totally... I totally lost track of that. Yeah. Yes, you're right. Very exciting news, right? This is last week, in fact, was our first birthday.
You know, I was looking at it. And so we recorded our first episode on October the 7th. But if I remember, and since we talked about it, I was looking at it some more. We recorded our first episode on October the 7th, but we recorded a couple episodes to have in the hopper when we got started. And we actually published on October the 21st. So by the time this episode goes live, then we actually will be publishing episode 52 on the same day, 1 year later, on October the 21st, 2014, when the first episode published on October the 24th, 2013. How's that for timing?
Dude, you might even go so far as to say we've thought about this. But you'd be completely wrong.
That's pretty freaking cool. Hey, congratulations for doing this for a solid year now. And this has been a lot of fun.
Oh yeah, no, likewise. Like it's tough, right? Like it's tough getting and recording for a show every week. So I know that sounds like we're patting ourselves on the back, but it's a year. We've done a great job, and you're a great partner in crime. So thanks for all of your effort in getting to a year.
Likewise, man. I totally agree. It is a lot more work than everyone probably thinks it is. And it wasn't really until the last month that we've actually brought in some outside help.
Yeah.
To where now we have someone that is who's producing the show for us. We send all the files over from the recordings, and he produces and cleans up the audio and does a phenomenal job. The last, I was it like four or five episodes he's done, I guess six now. And then we have somebody else who's handling the process from the second the recording is finished to getting him the files and then doing the whole thing about updating some stuff and posting the blog posts and the podcast entries and updating the feed and scheduling the podcast. It's all of that stuff. I mean, it's now we finally have somebody that's helping us do that stuff, but it's, it's cool. It's really cool. I'm looking around, kind of going up. I was kind of hoping we'd have a few, 1 year comments from some people that we could play on the air, but I think we're fresh out.
Yeah, maybe we'll get a couple from this.
How's that for a prod?
I don't know. I think it's a pretty cool milestone. Like, I'm really proud that we've managed to get a show out pretty much every week. We had a couple of gaps and then a couple of catch ups. So, all in all, I think it's been awesome. And I hope everybody's found it really useful and that we keep it going.
I do too. And it really is funny that the timing for episode 52 is shipping exactly 1 year after episode one shipped. But
that's pretty funny.
We honestly, before we started recording this, we do a little pre-chat before we record. Everybody's listening, and we looked at it, and we looked at the very first episode, and I looked at October the 7th, and I was like, okay, well, that's October 7th, 2013. I was like, well, wait a minute, that's the recorded date. We did not plan this at all. It just happened like this. And those three episodes we shipped that 1 week, like a week or two ago, or 3 weeks ago, something like that. That was not planned to get all the content out to make sure we get to 52 in 1 year. So that was, it just happened to work out like that. And
yeah, in hindsight, it was a great idea.
If you think that we planned that, then you give us a whole lot more credit than you should be giving us.
Yeah, we're really not that professional. Yeah.
No, it totally looked out. Oh, man.
Oh, that's cool.
Good stuff, though.
Oh, happy birthday.
Happy birthday to you, too. We'll have to sit there. We need where's Marilyn doing, coming out of a cake?
Yeah, I was going to say we should be drinking, but I've done a lot of that this week, and I think it would kill me. So
I could totally do that. I've had a full pot of coffee on my own this morning, so I could...
Oh, you're good to go.
I could definitely use a little bit of alcohol to kind of counteract the caffeine, but...
Nice.
At any rate, yeah, man. It's good times. And thank you, everybody that's listening. Thank you very much for subscribing. Everybody that's not listening, you guys are totally missing out, but they don't even hear it. So screw all you people who aren't listening.
Yeah, I mean, we wouldn't be doing this if we didn't think somebody was listening, right? And that it was valuable to people. So that's what really inspires me to keep going.
I'm sorry, what'd you say? Ha, 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 ha. All right, let's move on.
Yeah, cool. All right, so...
The news. There we go. A lot of stuff.
What's been going on the tubes? We've got a bit of stuff going on in the Azure world we should probably get through. You want to kick off with some goodies?
Absolutely, yeah. So we got three things here that have come up. I guess they've all these things have gone to general availability and some pricing stuff that's all Azure news related. So first one is instance level public IPs. So that basically says that you can create a public IP or you can reserve a public IP from the Azure team and map that to a virtual machine or map that to a virtual IP, a VIP, for your virtual machine. So you can have a static IP essentially pointing to it. That's gone to general availability. It's going to, as they say, it's going to let you assign a public IP address to VMs and web or worker roles so they become directly accessible without having to map an endpoint for access. With the instance level public IPs, you can enable scenarios like running FTP servers in Azure and monitoring VMs directly using their IPs. So when the feature became generally available, which it is now, the limit of 2 IPs per subscription was removed. So now I'm going to, all the pricing information that we'll share with these three things, they're all based on the East US region. So pricing can change between regions. So I'd encourage you to go check that out. Pricing for this, the first 5 public IPs you have in your subscription, those are $0 per IP. So a great low price.
Nice.
Additional IPs are going to be four tenths of a cent. So 0.4 pennies. Per hour, per IP address, which comes out to generally about $3 a month per IP. And that includes both the IPs that you've reserved and you're using or you're not using. So it just counts as reserved and then you have to map it.
Gotcha.
There is some measurements on remapping the IP. So if you go from, say, I want this public IP to point from this VM, now I want to point to this VM, the first 100 remaps that you do, those are free, those are included, but every additional remap that you do is going to cost you 10 cents. Pretty cool feature.
No, this is pretty cool because this is something people have had to struggle with. You know, if they've got a DNS entry pointing at an IP address, for example, then, you know, there's some tricks about leaving a small VM running to make sure you don't lose your public IP and things, but this will sort of help clear up those hacks.
Yep, definitely.
Yeah, it'll be nice to be able to just keep an IP and map it to the right spot, and you don't have to worry about like dynamic DNS or any weird stuff like that.
Yeah, so all you SharePoint guys that have been wanting to put your SharePoint farms in the cloud, I mean, if you're not using this today, then you can right away, if you've got a 3-server or a 5-server farm, you can do this for absolutely no cost at all. And if you want to do 2 farms, then you're looking at just doing $3 per VM a month. So that's not a bad price.
Yeah, that's actually pretty decent. And you get a bit of free stuff there too. So that's kind of cool.
Yep. So that's the first one we had. You got another one we got for us to share?
Yeah, sure. So the next one is Azure Site Recovery Replication to Azure has gone generally available. So this is if you want to basically replicate a bunch of Hyper-V VMs that you run in your like on-premises or in your data center or your hoster, and you want to replicate them to Azure for DR purposes. So this is a great option for those folks that are, you know, they want to keep running stuff on-prem or in their own data center, but they don't want to have to, you know, build out a whole separate DR site themselves. They could use Azure for that. So this service will basically help you replicate those VMs up into the Azure cloud and let you run them up there. So that's gone generally available. There's some pricing attached to it. So until November 30th, I guess after December 1st, it changes, right? So it'll be about $54 a month per instance after December 1st. So I'm guessing that that's still preview pricing until the end of November.
Yeah, so the pricing, what is it? It's 20, it's...
27.
Well, the customer-owned site, so you can, if you have VMs in Azure and then you are replicating them down to your on-prem data center, that's $16 a month. But if you're...
Oh, I see. They split the pricing out that way. Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah. So if you're on-prem and you're replicating up to Azure, then up to the end of November 2014 is $27 a month. After that, it's $54 a month. So 50% price cut and while until the GA kicks in on December the 1st.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is classic like cloud use case where now you don't... It's not just the deal with having to maintain a separate farm just for DR scenarios, but... I mean, if you got to maintain a separate farm for DR scenario, you have to buy all the hardware and have all that stuff sitting there and basically just have it there just to have it there in case something breaks.
Yep.
So it's like buying 2 cars and just having to pay for the second one to be insured and just sit there in the garage and wait until the first one somehow has a flat tire. It's just a ridiculous cost. But like, you know, doing this up in Azure, then it's you're just paying for a little bit of the storage and having this much, much lower cost that you have to have to maintain these VMs. And then when, you know, the proverbial thing hits the fan, then you've got your DNS switched over to using your new, your IP addresses up in the, on your VMs up in the cloud. And your performance may be a little bit slower because you're going from on-prem in, on your corporate LAN over to your, over across the WAN to get to your environments up in the cloud. But I mean, man, that's a, you're still up and running. You're just up and running a little bit slower. That's pretty freaking cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. And this was a common sort of stumbling block for a lot of customers where they wouldn't do DR properly because they didn't, or they couldn't pay for all the additional hardware and all the additional stuff they needed to run a proper DR environment. Well, they thought they couldn't afford it. But of course, when the shit hit the fan, they were wishing they had paid for it. But hopefully this way, it'll make it a little easier to set something up in a manner like that.
Agreed. Yeah, it's a really cool solution.
Yeah, no, it's nice. So there's so we've got some more news. Do you want to jump into the next one?
Absolutely. Yeah. So the last one here that we have is around Service Bus and primarily around pricing and new service tiers that they've offered. So back in earlier in the summer of 2014, Microsoft announced changes to queues and topics and messaging that was now offered, or that was going to be offered in two different tiers. Everything we knew before is now called the standard tier. And then we also now have a basic tier. So this goes along with things that they've been doing with their other offerings, like around websites and around VMs and around SQL. And so what this one does is that it gives you, if you're only using certain features, you can go with a much lower tier and pay less. So basically the way it works is you have two different tiers, standard and basic. Now, the standard one, that includes all the stuff we had before. So queues, topics, transactions, deduplication, scheduled messages, service bus brokered connections, all of that stuff. The pricing for that, again, this is all East US based region. The base charge, you have a $10 a month that you have to pay to kind of just use service bus. And then the first 12.5 million operations that you do, those are included in that $10. It goes all the way up to, if you're doing, see if I say this right, 2,500 million. Operations per month, that's going to cost you about, for everything above that, you're going to have to pay about 20 cents per million operations.
Yeah, that's billions.
Yeah, so billions, 2.5 billion. Yeah. So anything from 12.5 million up to 100 million is going to cost you about 80 cents per million operations. And then it scales even much higher than that. The difference is with basic, you lose all a bunch of the different things that you, in Service Bus, you drop down to just using the queues capability and a limited number of brokered connections, just 100. You're capped out at 100. The pricing for that is just 5 cents per million operations. And so if you need things like topics to where you're doing a pub sub thing or scheduled messages, you do need to go standard. The last aspect of this is when I'm talking about operations, everything is measured on a... where each operation is considered 64K kilobytes.
Oh, yeah.
But if the message that you're sending is greater than that, then they break up the pricing for two. So if you have something that's, if you have one message that's 64K and you have another message that is, 128K, then the first message counts as one operation. The second one is going to count as two operations, even though it's technically only one operation. So they just do that for billing.
Gotcha. No, Service Bus is really cool. I know I say that kind of in a whimsical tone, but it's a pretty critical piece of infrastructure. And I think it's nice to see it get these bumps. Cool. So that's the news. Anything sort of final on these three things you'd add before we move on?
No, I mean, it just, yet again, the Azure team is just coming out with more and more. They're coming with features, it seems like every week or every other week. I can't remember if I mentioned this on an earlier show, but a couple of weeks ago, I was a guest on another podcast called the Azure Podcast, where we talked about like SharePoint apps and how Azure kind of fits into it and just Azure Dev and all that stuff. So if anybody's interested, we'll put a link to the show notes for that episode that I did. But I was talking to them about just how crazily fast that they are revving stuff that, I mean, God, we could almost just segment out every two episodes can just be Azure news related stuff.
Yeah, no, definitely. They keep cranking it big time.
Yep.
Hey, so let's move on to the listener question that we got sent in.
You want me to read through this one or you want to?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Okay. This listener question was sent by, and forgive me if I mispronounce your name, but Kirk Limon. And the question is about, should InfoPath be off limits in SharePoint Online? And this was driven by episode 49 that we published a couple weeks ago, which was a recap of the InfoPath forums panel at the SharePoint TechCon conference in Boston in September. So Kirk says, so I'm going to read through this whole thing. It takes a second because it's not too long, but it just makes sure we get through the whole thing and then we'll jump into thoughts. So Kirk says, in episode 49, your SP TechCon panel recap on InfoPath, you had a good discussion of InfoPath and its future. One course of action is to still use InfoPath for solutions that can be revisited in the future. But he didn't hear any mention of this with regards to SharePoint Online. I'm leaning against this unless it is a very short-term need based on the following assumptions. First assumption is, number one, I believe that the next version of SharePoint is coming out in 2015. Number two, I believe the next version of SharePoint will be available in SharePoint Online first. Number three, tenants may have some say when they get the next version of SharePoint in SharePoint Online, but only to an extent. Maybe they can delay by a month or maybe even a year. Number four, I believe that InfoPath will not work in the next version of SharePoint. Can you speak to any assumptions about the above? If these assumptions are correct, any InfoPath solution built with SharePoint Online will stop working by 2017 or earlier. I wonder if the next version of SharePoint will still support InfoPath in any way. That's the key. Maybe it can support it in a similar to how SharePoint 2013 supports both 2010 and 2013 style workflows, but it's kind of apples to oranges. So I'm going to stop off the rest of the question here because I think we kind of get the crux of what Kirk is trying to say here. So
yeah.
You want to put your thoughts into it and I'll give mine as well?
Yeah. So I think for me, you know, I'm reading through this and I listen to you as you read it out. And I think there's a couple of things that he's really trying to say here. One is, well, the most critical thing is his fourth sort of bullet in the middle of that was, I believe that InfoPath will not work in the next version of SharePoint. Really not sure about this. I think that's kind of a critical point that we should address.
Yeah.
And so following that was, I wonder if the next version of SharePoint will support InfoPath in any way. So that's kind of the key to all of his question is he's saying that he thinks that InfoPath or solutions that are built using InfoPath will stop working in SharePoint or in SharePoint Online when the next version comes out. And then the rest of his comment seems to be based on that, right? So whether or not you should, you know, whether it's only a short-term thing or a long-term thing for the solution, all seems to be hinged on this. So my thoughts on this are, speaking as the sort of the Microsoft guy here for a second, we haven't said we're turning off InfoPath in SharePoint at all. So what we've said is there won't be another version of InfoPath itself. And we've also said that those will continue to be supported, you know, for the standard, you know, support life cycle of any product that we put out. But we haven't said we're turning off InfoPath in SharePoint Online or in SharePoint on-prem at all. And I think that's kind of a critical thing. So the first thing is forms that you've built and published in SharePoint today will not just sort of magically stop working, you know, when the next version of SharePoint comes out. We don't do that. Like, we don't turn stuff off and screw people over quite like that.
You do it a different way. I'm kidding.
We have policies around giving people notice and just randomly turning things off in the next version is not what we do. So for SharePoint on-prem, typically the way things that are deprecated, notice is given that it's deprecated. And that means basically it's not going to be switched off in the next release. It's going to be deprecated, which means it may be switched off in the following release after that. And then for SharePoint Online, which is obviously not on the same sort of release cadence that on-premises products are, it's much faster. We have a policy about not turning something off like that without giving a year's notice, at least a minimum of.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's kind of the critical point here is he's assuming that we're just going to randomly turn it off. And I think that's a mistake.
Yeah.
And that's the first thing that we should point out, that it's not going to sort of just magically disappear overnight.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, it's a Microsoft thing. And historically, Microsoft has not done that. They've not just kind of pulled the rug out from under. But I think, let me just throw a little bit more color here, Kirk. And this is not my... inside information or anything. This is just me reading the tea leaves and stuff. So I would feel very comfortable with InfoPath working in the next version of SharePoint. In fact, I would feel comfortable with InfoPath working in a custom solution that was built today for the foreseeable future, even going as far until the next, whatever the next thing is that ends up coming down the road or something like that. So I don't see that change. You rarely see a company like Microsoft come out and say, hey, this thing that you built 2 or 3 years ago everything is getting shut off and you're going to have to completely change things up. However, what I do think, some of the other points here, you said you believe the next version of SharePoint's coming out in 2015. The next on-prem one is definitely coming out, or they've said is coming out in 2015. And then you talk about some of the SharePoint Online stuff. I think that what we really need to start doing here is you need to look at SharePoint less like a packaged product, and you need to look at more like a service. And that's really where Microsoft is doing with SharePoint Online and stuff. They focused on going, all to the cloud. And so a lot of stuff was, all the development is focused on being built for the cloud, but then they said they're going to do an on-prem version. To me, I can't look at SharePoint anymore as different releases. It's more like these are updates, because is there such thing as a release anymore? I don't think we're going to see a massive change where there's a complete refresh of the UI and stuff in 2-3 years time. I think that, what we'll see are new features showing up, and lots of incremental updates are showing up, because that's just how you work with stuff in 365, or work with things in a cloud-based solution.
Yeah.
So I don't think that that's going to change anytime soon. I wouldn't look at it as a release date. I don't think that this one point where you say tenants can have some say when they get the next version of SharePoint and SharePoint Online, as far as having SharePoint on-prem, obviously you have full control over when you get the next version or the next update, because you control when that is installed. But as far as SharePoint Online goes, I do not see anything in the future, nor would I assume anything in the future is going to give me the ability to say, no, I don't want this, or let me postpone the same thing of like what I had when I was on the SharePoint 2010 bits in Office 365, and then my tenant was upgraded to 2013. I don't think that capability is going to be coming anytime soon. I don't think that Microsoft should do that at all. I think that if anything, we should have like a dev tenant or something that we can see what's coming, but we shouldn't be able to control like how they're deploying code in the environments and telling them how to run those things. The whole idea of the cloud is to get out of that business, and to try and give that kind of control, I think, just creates more challenge and frustrations. And if you don't like that, then that's when you need to stay on-prem and say, I need to control those things, so I need to be on-prem, I can't go cloud.
Yeah, that's a good point about sort of talking about like a version in the cloud is getting more and more difficult, because although technically there is a version number, if you're a developer, you go take a look at, there's a version you can go look at. That's really, it updates all the time. There's lots and lots of smaller ripples of features going into the service, every week. So new features and updates and tweaks and all those sorts of things. It doesn't all get bunched up and released, once a year or once every 2 years. It's, we're literally releasing every day.
I mean, there was a great example of that yesterday too, when there was an issue with the sweet bar that was reported on Twitter, where the sweet bar at the very top was taking a very long time to load based on an update that had gone out like that same day. I think the whole page was loading just fine, but the sweet bar was taking about 3 or 4 seconds for it to load. And I'm on this discussion list where someone reported the issue. Microsoft confirmed the issue. They opened up a case, a SEV1 case. They went through, fixed it. The fix has actually been created and implemented, and now it's just in the process of rolling out throughout the environment. So I agree with you. There's no such thing as a version in terms of packaged product. Version numbers are there. What still needs to be done, if only you knew somebody in the developer space on the SharePoint or 365. the two big requests that I have on the developer side for SharePoint or for Office 365 as a whole is one is having a manifest that I can go to and I can see what things are included in this release. So when a new release goes out, I can see a manifest of this, and this was added.
Oh yeah.
And so if Microsoft is saying we're rolling this out to people, if it's something very small, even if it's like a bug fix and an API, or it's a new endpoint that's been added, I'd like to be able to look at the version number and be able to know that, okay, this links to this thing over here, and there's a knowledge base article that says what this does, so I can see if I actually have that. Very much like when there's a Windows update, every Windows update has a Windows update ID that I can go to and see what was included in that patch. That's I would like to see that for 365.
Yeah, it's like release notes.
Exactly, yeah, I'd like to see release notes. And then the other thing that I would like to see is specifically because we're not really, because the APIs are so much more important in 365 now, both from the traditional SharePoint, CSOM and REST APIs, but then also for the newer Office 365 APIs. Today, the best I can tell, or I'm pretty sure of this, there's no versioning of those APIs. And so if I'm working against the REST API and I know of a bug that I'm trying there's a bug in the API or there's something, and I've created some sort of a workaround, or there's a feature that's not available in the API, and so I've created a workaround to address that. If I have something that's out there that's running that is taking advantage of that, and then Microsoft does either fix that bug or they add a feature to it, and then they roll that out to the production environments, then what happens to my custom solution? Does my workaround now break because all of a sudden the API changed and only breaks for some people? And what?
Yeah, the behavior, right?
Yeah, and so where I'm going with this is that what I want to see is the Office 365 team as a whole, and the SharePoint team is included in this. I want to see Microsoft have a versioning of the APIs that's out there, very much the same way how Salesforce does it, very much how Azure does it. There's different ways of doing it. Salesforce does it by changing the URL. So I've written something that 2 years ago, I wrote something that works with the Salesforce API, but it worked against version, I think it was version 23. And so in the URL, I went to an endpoint and then went /23.2, but they're up to like in the 30s or late 20s now. And if I want my code to use the fix that they've put in there, I have to fix my code and change the endpoint that I'm going to. So the old, I can still work with the old broken API, but my code addresses that. The Azure team does a similar thing where they use a header in every request, and you basically say something like, I want to use the API as of this date. I prefer a mix of those. I prefer having it in the header, but not basing it on a date, instead basing it on a number. And I think that SharePoint has to base it on a number because the dates don't apply, because we got different farms could have different numbers on any given day.
Yeah, no, it's definitely something we're working on.
Yeah.
So back to Kirk's original question about InfoPath, you've got any little tidbits of advice for him on whether he should be using InfoPath now or what his options are?
Yeah, the general thing that I'm telling everyone when this question comes up, same thing I've been saying for a few months. If you have existing things that are using InfoPath, don't run to your admin and start figuring out how to rip it out. Leave it as is. Any existing projects that you're building InfoPath forms for, I think you kind of have to take them on a case-by-case basis. Anything that is involving any significant InfoPath development, anything, and by that I mean anything beyond simply replacing the edit forms that we have on lists, I would not go forward with that. I would not go use InfoPath for any new development of anything beyond just editing forms. Today, what you do is there's options with, like we talked about in episode 49, there's Excel surveys. I tend to generally go with the option of getting a web developer to build a form and have it submitted. That way, the other option that I've actually done this, I did this recently for someone, and it worked out really well. And I know Microsoft definitely doesn't want us to be doing this, but the customer needed it done, so it got it done. I created a form in Google Docs. The form, as people filled out the form, first I could embed it in a SharePoint page. And as people filled out the form, the responses went into an Excel spreadsheet. And then there's a custom service that we created that actually uses the Google API to look at the file in Google Docs and Google Drive, open up the spreadsheet, consume that, and spit that back as an OData service. And then we created an external content type using BCS that exposed the results of that Google form as a SharePoint list.
Gotcha. Now that's pretty nifty.
Yeah. There was no integration with SharePoint data, but that was the big downside. But I mean, it worked, and it did require a developer to get involved, but it's all we could do today.
Yeah, I think my only advice on that side of things is, yeah, I agree with you. If you've got stuff already built, keep going. Like, it's not going to be turned off overnight. We're going to give people notice if we ever consider doing that. So you're safe there. And then moving forward, I think it really just boils down to that same sort of approach of finding the best tool for the choice, right? And there are lots of options, for forms, right? There's, third-party stuff like from Nintex, for example. You could go outside and use something like SurveyMonkey as well, it really depends on what your scenario is and what your requirements are, depending on which choice would be the best. But there are lots of alternatives as well. So you can still build stuff in InfoPath. Feel free to go ahead and do that. But my recommendation is just to sort of evaluate your options and make sure it's going to be the best choice for you.
Yeah. There's plenty of third-party options. We're still, as far as what is the solution for Microsoft, frankly, you just got to kind of hang tight and wait until they come out with something, because right now it's the story is it's InfoPath today. They talk about access services. They talk about Excel surveys. Beyond that, it's kind of a wait and see.
Yeah. Hey, so thanks, Kirk, for sending in your question. If others have other ones like this or on any other topic, feel free to send them in to us. We love getting the emails, or record your question and send it in. So, yeah, thanks again, Kirk. And thanks for AC on your thoughts on this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And same to you, man. And hey, congratulations on episode V1 year.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm really pleased about that. I think it's great we've made it. And I hope everybody is enjoying the show or continuing to enjoy the show.
Absolutely. Me too. Okay. Hey, let us know what you want to hear. Let us know what you've thought about the podcast, what kind of things, other things you'd like to hear us talk about that are Microsoft Cloud related. You know, I guess another thing too that'll be interesting is by the time this goes live, we'll be on the eve of the Microsoft MVP Summit, where Microsoft brings a bunch of MVPs in from all around the world, and we all kind of get together. There are a lot of people who are doing Office 365 and cloud-based development. And if there's something, a topic you'd like to hear about, I mean, we're all going to be there, and it'd be a great chance for CJ and I to kind of wrestle a few people, or maybe have a roundtable discussion on some stuff, and opportunity for some great things. So we got a couple ideas, but I mean, what do you want to hear? That's the big thing.
Yeah, definitely. All right, thanks, AC. Great show. 1 year down. Let's keep it going.
10 more to go.
Rock on. All right, thanks, AC. Great show.
Take care, bud.
1 year down.
If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as a WAV or MP3 and provide a link so we can play your question on the show. You can subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Microsoft Cloud Show, or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find a full transcript and show notes of each episode. You can also find us on Facebook, searching for Microsoft Cloud Show, or on Twitter at MS Cloud Show. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.